number two. Close aides of the late Congressman Leo Ryan have reported publicly that his ill-fated decision to go to Guyana was triggered by a State Department report to him that he found unsatisfactory. As I have mentioned already, this reaction of Ryan's had been predicted and, in fact, deliberately encouraged. With elections coming up, Congressman Ryan decided to schedule the trip after the election, during the congressional recess. This was a natural decision, and had also been anticipated by the planners behind the scenes. And as the time approached for his trip, the false issue of the Cuban MiG-23 crisis erupted. The Carter administration had learned nearly 1 year ago that the Russians were going to send the MiG-23s to Cuba and decided that it would be the perfect pretext for a fake crisis. The MiG-23, my friends, can carry certain types of nuclear weapons as claimed. But even in this role, it is a tactical weapon, best suited for support of ground or naval forces. The MiG-23 in and of itself does not threaten America in the same way that the 1962 Cuban missiles did. And so when the United States began playing up the MiG-23s, it was very obvious to the Kremlin that this was a deliberate effort to stir up public tension over Cuba. The question was, exactly what was the United States up to? Would the Carter administration be so crazy as to invade Cuba? Such a thing sounded irrational, but America's unseen rulers are behaving more and more irrationally. Partly this is deliberate and is intended to keep the chess players in the Kremlin off balance, but it is also partly a result of the increasing degree of control over America by those satanic schizophrenics, the Bolsheviks. Cuba is, after all, very important to Russia, for Russia is looking ahead to world domination after nuclear war won. And for that, Cuba is Russia's main beachhead in the Western Hemisphere. Even more urgently, Cuba is the unadmitted home of Russia's Caribbean submarine fleet. This fleet has repeatedly moved into attack positions in the Gulf of Mexico over the past 2 years and more, during periods of tension. And as if that were not enough, there are concentrations of nuclear weapons in at least 4 land locations in Cuba. One is near the north coast, roughly 10 miles inland, southeast of Cardenas. This location is 150 miles due south of Cape Sable, Florida. A second site is about 150 miles to the east, southeast of that, and about 10 miles inland from the north coast. 125 miles farther to the southeast is a third concentration, 15 miles northeast of Martí, well inland. And a fourth nuclear site is near the eastern tip of Cuba, 28 miles north-northwest of the United States Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay. With all this at stake, American publicity over the MiG-23s caused worry in the Kremlin. And in early November, the tension increased when the United States began sending SR-71 reconnaissance flights over Cuba, shades of 1962. In response, massive formations from the Atlantic, Pacific, and Caribbean submarine fleets of the Russian Navy began fanning out along America's east, west, and Gulf coasts on November 6th. They did not deploy into attack formations, but their sheer numbers signaled a clear warning to Washington. At this very moment, they are still on station, many with neutron weaponry. Then during the week immediately preceding the tragedies in Guyana, the MiG-23 pseudo-crisis built to a climax. Beginning on Tuesday, November 14th, a huge combined American and British naval task force began heading toward Cuba. By midweek, Cuban defense forces were on full alert. And on Thursday, November 16th, a group of 12 United States senators in Moscow, supposedly to discuss the SALT talks, met with Russia's Kosygin. There, they pressed the alleged issue of the Cuban MiG-23s, and Kosygin flew into a rage. He shouted, "I thought you were here to discuss peace." According to James Reston's New York Times article of November 26, 1978, one senator, John Glenn of Ohio, reportedly tried to defuse the MiG-23 argument, calling it a false issue, quote unquote. As a former test pilot and America's first astronaut in orbit, Senator Glenn knew what he was talking about. But Kosygin's anger over the other comments about the MiGs provided the United States intelligence community with valuable proof that the decoy action toward Cuba was working. The next day, November 17th, Russia publicly admitted sending MiG-23s to Cuba, calling them strictly defensive weapons. The same day, an editorial in the Washington Post typified the crescendo of media attention to the Cuban MiG-23s. It was titled, A New Cuban Missile Crisis? The very next day, Saturday, November 18th, Congressman Leo Ryan, three newsmen and a woman, seeking to escape from Jonestown, were slaughtered at the Port Kaituma Airport. At least a dozen other people were also wounded, but there was no effort to destroy the airplane filled with terrified escapees from Jonestown. Instead, many witnesses were left alive, and a smaller plane managed to take off right after the airport massacre and report the attack in the capital, Georgetown. Immediately, world attention was focused on Guyana. And meanwhile, the mass murder at Jonestown, wrongly called a mass suicide, was underway. At this point, the elaborate decoy action toward Cuba was no longer needed. So the Pentagon announced that a routine naval exercise was in progress, which would approach no closer to Cuba than 50 miles. Cuban defense forces relaxed, but the real action was only beginning in Guyana. The methodical executions of Congressman Ryan and three prominent newsmen had guaranteed that Jonestown would shortly be in the glare of publicity. Having guaranteed this publicity, Jim Jones then ordered the mass executions at the Jonestown kibbutz. The complete details of the Jonestown disaster may never be known publicly. I can tell you, though, that of those who died there, very few willingly and deliberately took their own lives. And that is what suicide is. Many were tricked, not realizing that the death rites were real. Many more resisted, but they were weak, helpless, and confronted with armed execution squads. So by various means, several hundred people were poisoned with potassium cyanide. However, there were many others who did try to escape and who resisted more effectively. Many of these people were herded off into the jungle and shot without mercy. Finally, when the mass murder was completed, the executioners performed their final task of stage managing the horrible death scene. In order to achieve the surprise needed in attacking the Russian missile base, it was critically important that the first reports from Jonestown describe the scene as a mass suicide. Only in this way could its actual military significance be hidden long enough to fool the Russians. So all the bodies that were free of gunshot wounds were carefully arranged in neat rows and other groupings, suggesting at first sight that everyone died willingly and deliberately. This was the scene that greeted Guyanese troops late the following day, Sunday, November 19. It was more than 24 hours after the kibbutz victims died, and the executioners, including the real Jim Jones, were long gone. I will return to the matter of Jones himself later. The Guyanese troops were afraid of possible disease, but counted the bodies as accurately as possible. The total they reported was 409 Sunday night. The initial impression of a mass suicide was seized upon by the controlled major media of the United States. Without waiting for an investigation, the media drummed away at the suicide image of Jonestown as if it were a proven fact. After a few days, a few people did begin to raise questions, but by then, the initial image of suicide had served its purpose of opening Guyana's doors to the United States. For example, on Tuesday, November 21, Jim Jones' surviving son, Stephen, said in a Georgetown press conference, quote, "There's no way it could have been mass suicide," unquote. And the same day, according to the Washington Star, a Guyanese source pointed out a serious medical discrepancy in the Jonestown kibbutz death scene. He said, quote, "If you die of cyanide, which seems to have been the poison, your body goes into spasm and contorts in death. But at Jonestown, everyone looked relaxed," unquote. The reason for this discrepancy, my friends, was that by the time the Guyanese troops arrived, all the bodies had been rearranged, as I have stated. They were also placed face down for the most part. This was so that the widely publicized news photos would not ruin the desired impression of calm by letting us see the victim's final expressions of agony. To continue the nightmare charade to fool the Russians, the United States at first publicly urged Guyana to collect and bury the hundreds of bodies. As arranged, Guyana replied in effect that it was America's problem and that America should take the bodies back to the United States. To facilitate this huge and hideous task, Guyana obligingly agreed to waive the usual Guyanese law that requires anybody to be autopsied before removal from the country. With this arrangement, the United States achieved the carte blanche military access to Guyana that was needed. Russian intelligence realized what was afoot by early Monday, November 20, but it was already too late to stop it. Russia could hardly announce to the world, "We have a secret nuclear missile base in Guyana, and the United States is getting ready to destroy it." That would have rallied world opinion behind America. And although Russian cosmospheres quickly converged over Guyana, they too were useless in the covert conditions of battle there. Their charged particle beam weapons could have made short work of the commando-style forces, but in the process, they would have wiped out the Russian base itself. The Guyana missiles had become only a minor factor in Russia's military power since the Battle of the Harvest Moon last year. They were not valuable enough to Russia to declare open war on their account. And so under these conditions, Russia was powerless to act once the Jonestown tragedy had been staged. As Thanksgiving Day approached, huge American transports, helicopters, troops, and medical teams swarmed into Guyana. In a remote corner of the huge Temara airfield, a command post was established for the twin operations at Jonestown and at the Russian missile base. As some of the troops began the nauseating task of cleaning up the Jonestown kibbutz, other joint attack forces were taking up positions around the missile base in preparations for the surprise raid. Meanwhile, day after day, the death count reported at Jonestown remained unchanged at 409. Then on Thanksgiving Day itself, the Battle of Guyana took place. Crack military forces, experienced in jungle and surprise warfare, moved in on the Russian complex, striking all the dispersed sites simultaneously. Like the Entebbe raid, the battle itself did not last long. It had to be over quickly to be successful. First, the small crews on site near each missile were overwhelmed and then killed. The missiles themselves were quickly disabled. Next, the military forces converged on the missile command and control center, where a bloody pitched battle took place. When the smoke cleared, every single person manning the missile base had been killed, including the Russian commanders. When the battle was over, American helicopters from Temara Airfield began landing within the ruined missile complex and flying out the wounded. Then the remaining attackers were left with two more jobs before they could retire from the area. First, they were under strict orders to leave no bodies of the attacking forces on Guyanese soil. And so the entire area was scoured until every single member of the attacking force had been accounted for. Their bodies, like those of the victims at Jonestown, were sealed in Vietnam-type body bags and collected in clearings where helicopters could land to pick them up. Finally, the combined forces were under orders to remove the nuclear warheads from the missiles and take them back to Georgetown for airlift to the United States. Specially trained members of the attacking force had set to work on this task immediately after the initial attacks on the missile crews. By early Friday, November 24th, all the warheads had been removed. They, too, were placed in body bags, one per bag, with some jungle foliage stuffed in to give the bag a reasonable appearance. Of course, none of this was apparent to the reporters at the Mara airfield, whose access to the American command post there was carefully controlled. When wounded members of the joint forces were flown back to the airfield after the Battle of Guyana on Thanksgiving afternoon, they were kept out of sight of the reporters. Otherwise, when reporters occasionally saw body bags being moved from place to place, they naturally assumed that all contained victims from Jonestown. They had no way of knowing that some contained slain commandos and that others contained Russian nuclear warheads. The continual cargo of death from the Jonestown kibbutz made the perfect cover for the aftermath of the Battle of Guyana. Some reporters have been puzzled at the choice of Dover Air Force Base in Delaware for the Guyana airlift. Most of the Jonestown victims were from California, and there is a mortuary facility similar to the Dover facility at Oakland Air Force Base in California. Dover was chosen, my friends, to facilitate transfer of the Russian nuclear warheads to the nearby Aberdeen Proving Ground and Arsenal. This was done by means of shuttle flights from Dover to Phillips Air Force Base. Originally, the Guyanese count of 409 had been accepted as firm by United States officials in Guyana. That had raised questions as to where the rest of the 1,000 or so residents reported to be in Jonestown had gone. Finally, on Thanksgiving Day, with the body cleanup operation well underway, a military spokesman told reporters, quote, "The evaluation that we have made is simply that there were not many more people in Jonestown at the time of the suicide," unquote. But even as he spoke, the Battle of Guyana was raging at the Russian missile base. By midday on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, 485 body bags had already arrived at the Temara airfield. The bodies and warheads from the Russian missile base were destined to raise the total far beyond the total of 409 bodies originally counted by the Guyanese at the kibbutz. It was a bad mistake, the kind of thing that happens in the heat of battle. Something had to be done, and fast. So on that Friday after Thanksgiving, a breathless and nervous Pentagon spokesman at the Temara airfield made a stunning announcement over CBS television. Quote, "The original count of persons found dead at the Jonestown site has been found to be seriously in error. It now appears there may be as many as 780 bodies total found at the site. They were found simply buried under other bodies. There were larger adults that were grouped together, and under their bodies were found the bodies of smaller adults and children," unquote. Badgered by incredulous reporters, the government embellished the cover story later on. The Washington Star quoted the same spokesman as saying Friday night, quote, "Near the center of the pile of bodies near the assembly hall, they were three deep in some areas. They were in layers with blankets between them," unquote. This story was so unbelievable that within 2 days, the United States government dismissed its own story about the blankets as a rumor, quote, unquote. Still, the basic idea of bodies on top of bodies had to be maintained. So on Saturday, November 25th, another Air Force spokesman tried to make it all sound plausible in the following words, quote, "From what I observed, the people, when they committed suicide, would line up in nice, neat little circles, children in front of them. And as they died, they folded into the interior of the circle," unquote. The Guyana cover-up is worldwide in its dimensions. In Guyana, Deputy Prime Minister Reid made the first public announcement to the Guyanese people about Jonestown on Friday afternoon, November 24, in Parliament. Then he refused to answer questions and rushed out to cries of shame, shame, and cover-up from Parliament members. And here in the United States on Thanksgiving Day, FBI Director William Webster said that the, quote, "FBI Disaster Squad has positively identified the body of James Warren Jones through fingerprint identification records," unquote. But my friends, they fingerprinted a look-alike. Jones himself was at that very moment making good his escape from Guyana. All the preparations for Jones to make his escape had been made well in advance. An ocean-going boat, well stocked with supplies and money, was waiting for him near the river town of Bartica, 35 miles southwest of Georgetown. In order to make his way to Bartica from Jonestown, Jones had a safe conduct pass. In the early morning of Thanksgiving Day, as the Battle of Guyana was beginning, Jones headed downstream toward Georgetown. Shortly after noon Guyana time, his boat left the mouth of the Essequibo River into the Atlantic Ocean. From there, Jones followed a complicated itinerary which was designed to prevent his being followed. But in spite of that, my friends, he was followed. From Guyana, Jones headed due east for about 330 miles and then turned south, landing near Ramire, French Guiana, about 5:30 a.m. local time, November 27th. From there, he traveled by land to the capital, Cayenne, and took an airplane across the Atlantic Ocean to Freetown, Sierra Leone, in West Africa. From Freetown, he headed north along the coast to Guinea-Bissau Airport, arriving at approximately 7 p.m. local time, November 28. There, less than 2 hours later, he boarded a DC-3 and took off. His route took him eastward to Tambacounda, Senegal. From there, onward into Mali, with stops at Ségou, Mopti, and Gao. Then onward to Agadez, Niger, and Largo, Chad. From there, his plane continued to Atbara, Sudan, and then a short final hop to Port Sudan, where he arrived shortly after 4 o'clock this morning, November 30, local time. When he arrived at Port Sudan, Jones found a turboprop executive transport waiting for him, owned and operated by Israeli intelligence. Within 20 minutes, the plane took off with Jones and headed up the middle of the Red Sea toward the Gulf of Aqaba. At 6:30 a.m. local time this morning, November 30, Jones's plane landed briefly at Eilat, the back door to Israel, then onto a private airport outside of Jerusalem, arriving at 7:20 a.m. local time. From there, he headed to a nearby location for an intelligence debriefing. After being transformed gradually into a conscious agent of the intelligence community over the past half dozen years, Jones has taken part in a joint operation by American and Israeli intelligence in Guyana. The Israelis had contributed valuable expertise and even key lieutenants for Jones in showing how the Jonestown kibbutz could be set up and used for the intended purposes. One has only to look at an encyclopedia to see that Jonestown was, in fact, a kibbutz. For example, the World Book Encyclopedia under the topic Israel says, quote, "In a collective community called a kibbutz, the farmers share all the property and combine their labor. The village administration provides all their needs. The adults eat together in a dining hall, but married couples and single persons have private sleeping quarters. All children are raised together in a separate home. Parents visit their children for an hour or two before supper," unquote. My friends, the word communism, which has been domesticated here in America, means living in a commune. There is no purer form of commune than the Israeli kibbutz. When a commune is run by persons with satanic, schizophrenic characteristics, like those of Jim Jones, murderous and suicidal behavior are forced upon the people, as happened at Jonestown. And when this example is expanded to include an entire nation, one has a nation in the grip of Bolshevism. It is happening now to America, and we ourselves are being led and forced into national suicide against our will. Topic number 3. Many Americans today tend to think of World War II as having started on December 7, 1941. That was the day when open warfare came to America at Pearl Harbor. But World War II really began over 2 years before Pearl Harbor, on September 1, 1939. On that day, Hitler's troops marched into Poland, unleashing a tide of events that swept Germany and Japan crashing into ruins. So from that day onward, it made no sense to talk about preventing World War II. The question became instead, how to end the war? In the same way, my friends, it no longer makes any sense to speak of preventing Nuclear War I because it has already begun. It began secretly on Thanksgiving Day, November 23, 1978, with the Battle of Guyana. And while America's nationwide Pearl Harbor still lies in the future, all evidence indicates that this time we do not have 2 years to wait. As this secret war continues prior to open all-out war, we must now brace ourselves for Russian retaliation against the United States. By destroying their missile base in Guyana, America and Israel wiped out an overseas Russian military installation and killed Russian personnel. And they did so in a way that made any public protest by Russia impossible. In the past, Russia has often retaliated in kind whenever injured, and may well do so again this time. If so, geophysical warfare could well be the ideal tool, destroying a military installation seemingly by natural disaster. In the Battle of the Harvest Moon 14 months ago, America lost, and the very rules of war were altered. Russia then tried to force America to surrender through SALT II disarmament. But our unseen rulers instead stepped up preparations for a suicidal nuclear war. Now, in Guyana, the opening scenes of nuclear war have already given a preview for the entire war. By the standards of those who planned it, the Battle of Guyana was a brilliant success, and yet, at what cost? Many times more American lives were deliberately sacrificed than were lost by the enemy in the battle itself. In the same way, the American first strike strategy, which I detailed 3 months ago, will cause American deaths to dwarf those inflicted on Russia. The Battle of Guyana was an exercise in futility, a mere scratch on the arm for Russia. It was planned before the Battle of the Harvest Moon, which rendered this month's battle in Guyana obsolete before it happened. Perhaps the lessons for all of us were best summarized in the ironic sign that hung over Jim Jones's throne in the grisly silence at Jonestown. Quote, "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Unquote. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.